The American government has been waging a constant battle against the international hard drug trade in an attempt to stop the further addiction of Americans and to break up the crime networks that import and sell the drugs. Obviously, no solutions have been found, and there is strenuous debate over the best methods for drug control. I have two guests with me who have strong views and enormous first-hand experience with drug control policy. My guests are Peter Bourne and David Feingold. Dr. Peter Bourne formulated America's drug control policy under President Carter when he served as Special Assistant for Health Issues, which included responsibilities for drug abuse policy. Prior to assuming that position, in Georgia, he served as Director of the Office of Drug Abuse and Assistant Director of the Special Office of Drug Abuse Prevention. From 1974 to 76, he served as consultant to the United Nations Division on Narcotics Drugs. His other area of expertise is world health and the world food supply, and he's currently Assistant Secretary General of the UN's International Drinking Water Supply and Sanitation Decade. Dr. David Feingold, who has been with us before on Fresh Air, has studied the opium trade in Southeast Asia for about 20 years. His work as an anthropologist in Asia led him to study the role the poppy crops play in the economics, politics, and social structure of the people of Southeast Asia. He's lived with the Shan rebels, who control much of the opium trade in Burma, and with the villagers who grow and harvest the poppy crops. He was a consultant to the House Select Committee on Narcotics Abuse and Control in 1978, at which Peter Bourne testified, and he's currently director of the Center for Opium Research, which is part of ISHI, the acronym for the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, which is based in Philadelphia at the Science Center. Welcome, both of you, to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Dr. Peter Bourne, let's start with you. What do you think the goals of a strong national drug policy should be?
Well, the primary goals that we tried to establish in the last administration were to try to reduce primarily the adverse health and social consequences of drug use. That is, to keep the overdose death rates to the lowest possible level, to try to reduce the availability of drugs as a way of keeping down the crime rate, and to try to separate the health objectives from moral issues, from legal issues, and to try to deal with them individually.
David Feingold, what do you think the priorities of a government drug control policy should be?
I would essentially agree with the points that Peter made. It seems to me that the point of any drug policy should be to ameliorate the social costs and the health costs of drug use. It seems to me people are going to use drugs. You know, we've never found a society in which people don't use drugs. And therefore, what the goal of policy would be to help prevent particularly deleterious sorts of drug use, and also to seek to provide people with the kinds of treatment alternatives and to use prevention programs to keep people from entering into sorts of drug abuse that they might find particularly harmful.
What was the system that you established or tried to establish when you were in the administration?
Well, we felt very much that the most effective way of dealing with drug abuse was to try to reduce the availability of the drugs as near to their source as possible. The further one gets away from the source of cultivation or manufacture of a drug, the harder it becomes to control it. We therefore felt that particularly, for instance, with opium, which provides the heroin for our markets here in the United States, dealing with the cultivation of opium and trying either to interdict the opium when it was first being harvested or to encourage farmers to grow something other than opium really had to be the key to our strategy. In addition, law enforcement efforts to interrupt the trafficking into this country and providing treatment for people who became addicted obviously had to be an aspect of the overall policy also.
What did you find to be the most effective ways of stopping the drug traffic as close to the source as possible?
Well, at the time that President Carter took office, the major source of drugs coming into this country, of heroin coming into this country, was from Mexico. During a two-year period, we virtually eliminated that source by a combined U.S.-Mexican effort to eradicate opium cultivation in Mexico. Varying amounts were coming then from Southeast Asia, and particularly from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran. because of the political turmoil in that last area of the world, it has become extremely difficult to control the cultivation of opium there now. And in fact, that is, at the present time, the single largest source of opium and heroin coming to the United States.
How much of an emphasis was there on enforcement, on hardware to help grab people involved with the illegal trade and to interdict the drugs in that trade?
Well, a substantial amount of effort is put into that area. Some of it is for political reasons, because if you want to get the cooperation of foreign governments, you have to a certain extent, go along with what they are willing to accept, so that helping to provide hardware and training for their law enforcement agencies sometimes was essential if you also wanted to do a herbicide or eradication program of the opium. Also, in this country, I think that the general public understands law enforcement, the narcs kicking in the doors and seizing the drugs, so that that kind of approach has strong public appeal in this country. Whether or not it contributes very significantly to solving the drug problem is really another issue.
David, as a researcher who is frequently a consultant to, but otherwise outside of formal policy formulations, you've been critical at various times of our government's policy for drug control. What have been some of your criticisms?
Well, I think my criticisms were run by like this, that essentially what you have to look at is not what I think Peter was quite right to call the popular appeal of catching bad guys. That might be useful in the United States, but the effect worldwide is that since, by the most optimistic government estimates now, that they never stop more than 7% of the total drugs that leave the field, it means that you're running a program that guarantees that 97% of the illicit drugs get through. And so what you do is, first of all, you're effectively running a price support program for heroin around the world, because inefficient enforcement is worse in a way than no enforcement. Because what happens is that you're doing two things. One, you push the price up a little bit, but actually you give people an excuse to raise the price quite a lot because of the so-called risk factor. But obviously the risk factor is low. Secondly, you operate as a selective mechanism on the market. Since you only catch the least efficient smuggling operations, you continually guarantee that you get more and more efficient smuggling operations. For example, during the period of time when there was considerable American support for an enforcement effort in Burma and Thailand, there was never more than 10% of a particular caravan that was stopped. Now, what happened over a period of time is that you had a drop in the total crop coming out, which was hailed as a success. It then turned out that this was due, now we find out, it was due to the fact that there was a drought for 2 years. Right, this year, there is predicted to come out of Southeast Asia 600 metric tons of opium. And when I was last in Bangkok a couple of months ago, I was interviewing the head of the DEA there, and he said to me, well, he said, you know, we're slowing down the caravans. And I said, well, what do you mean you're slowing down the caravans? I said, you know, Sean Caravan, if there's a pretty girl in a village, they'll stop for 2 months and wait up, and they still bring it down. And he said, well, they're not bringing it down so much with mules anymore. And I said, but are they still bringing it down? He said, yes. So in other words, the main impact of our program there is that we've severely damaged the economy of the muleteers. We haven't done much to anyone else. And it seems to me you can go sort of around the world and look at this. One other point I'd like to make. The question of looking at different countries, it's very easy, as we sort of, you know, mentioned Burma and Mexico and Iran and so forth, to see the problem as in a unified way. But in fact, there was a very big difference between the kind of situation of opium production in Mexico and the kind of situation of opium production, say, in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia. Opium in Mexico was essentially an intrusive crop. At least one of the reasons why the Mexicans were growing opium is that there was pressure from the United States during World War II for Mexicans to grow opium to provide coating for us. But it was not a traditional crop in Mexico. So it was being grown essentially by the fact that people rather high up in the chain were getting people rather low down to produce drugs for them. Whereas in Southeast Asia, you have essentially a traditional crop and people growing opium because they can't grow anything else. And until we provide people with something else to grow, we're not going to be very successful. And this is something I think probably we'd both like to talk a little more about later.
Well, I'd like to hear your reactions, Peter Bourne, to what David Feingold has just said.
Well, I think that's right. Obviously, each country is a different situation, and you need a different strategy to deal with it. I think perhaps of all the drugs that we deal with, opium is the one that potentially lends itself to the most effective control. It can only come from one substance of the opium poppy. It is, as we have better development in parts of Asia and also Mexico, it will become an increasingly less attractive crop economically. I think that we are achieving better and better ways of monitoring it. The biggest obstruction at the present time to controlling opium are really political problems. If you have political instability, if you have a great deal of corruption, those are the problems more than anything else that make it difficult to control opium. The main difficulty in Burma is that you've got an insurgent movement which is supported by various external governments in northeastern Burma, and it makes it almost impossible then for the central government, no matter how committed it is to dealing with the problem, to really control its own territory adequately to stop the flow of the drugs.
Before we get to that question of instable governments, what do you think of the 2 points that David Feingold was mentioning, which is that an ineffective drug control policy tends to be a price support system, and that by catching a few people in the drug ring, but not many, that you're actually catching the least efficient and making it easier for the most efficient to operate?
Well, I think you have to accept the fact that you're never going to stop drug flow entirely. You also have to ask, what would the situation be if we weren't doing what we're doing? I always think that the analogy of weeding a garden is a good one, that you have to keep weeding all the time if you want the flowers to grow, but you're never going to make the weeds go away completely. And I think that the best we can hope to do is to reduce the availability of heroin in this country to the lowest level possible. I think it's probably fair to say that at the time that I left the Carter administration, the availability of heroin in this country was at the lowest level it had been in 10 years. It's now come back up again somewhat, but I don't think we ever thought that we would totally eliminate it. And I don't think there's any strategy that would really be effective at the moment in doing that.
You've both referred to the importance of dealing with the economics and politics of the countries in which opium is being grown. How do you do that, Peter Bourne? How do you assess what the government is and who to deal with there and what the appropriate method is for that specific country?
I feel very strongly that the biggest threat posed in this country and worldwide from the availability of drugs is the economic threat that it poses, much more than the effect of the drug substance itself. Vast amounts of money are being made from the trafficking in drugs. The result is that you have unbelievably widespread corruption at all levels of government in many producer countries. You have many vested interests in those countries that don't want to see the drug trafficking situation change. You have a situation in this country now where drugs, dollar for dollar, are the major industry in this country, outranking Exxon or General Motors as a source of income. It's estimated as being an industry of about $80 billion a year. There are an awful lot of Americans making vast amounts of money out of drug trafficking. As a result of that, I think that you have more and more caution on the part of many government agencies about who they're going to go after, how high a level they're going to try to go after the drug trafficking at. It encourages people to go down to the lower levels and arrest the street-level pushers, but not go to the big financiers who are really promoting drug trafficking. And I just see this as a serious problem. It poses a very serious threat in states like Florida and to some extent in California and Hawaii. In some countries overseas, we not only have people up to the level of the head of state involved in drug trafficking, we also have situations where even in relatively democratic countries, people who are in effect drug-sponsored candidates who are financed by the trafficking interests run for elective office and get elected. More and more, I think, we are seeing that the politics of many countries in the world really run by drug trafficking interests. Now, one can argue about how bad that may be. It may not always be that bad if it's bringing large amounts of foreign exchange into relatively underdeveloped countries. But I think it's a problem we really have to face up to, and I think certainly in our own social structure in this country, it is a serious threat to the social order and the economic structure of many states.
David, you've also said that drugs are the biggest money-making industry in America today. So given the involvement of some people in power in the drug trade, both here and in other countries, how do you take that into consideration, do you think, when you're formulating policy?
I'd like to get back to something I said before in relation to that. Peter used the analogy of weeding a garden. I tend to use the analogy of giving inadequate dosages of antibiotics. That if you give inadequate dosages of antibiotics, it's worse than not giving any antibiotics at all because you produce resistant strains. I think that one of the things that's important is I completely agree with Peter on the question of the significance of the economics. One of the things that's shocking is if you take the area of drugs, and we've been doing research on drugs for a very long time with considerable expenditures of money. Under the new administration, we will be doing a lot less research because they're not spending very much money at all. But one of the least researched areas is, in fact, the economics of drugs. Most of the studies that have been done have essentially been what one would call intelligence studies, or they have been based upon there are models that are based on suppositions that, in fact, don't have very good data to go with them. But actually, you could spend a week and literally read everything that has been written on the economics of drugs. And this is something that is a great lack. We know far more about rehabilitation or treatment or various sort of other things. Doesn't mean we're always successful. We know much more about it. If you're going to do that, I think that you have to separate two different things. One is the question of corruption. And corruption is rather easy to understand. I mean, let's say that you're a Thai policeman and you have a wife and children to support, and there is a shipment of heroin that is coming down on a truck, and someone says to you, here is $20,000, which is more than you might make in 4 years or 5 years or 6 years or 10 years, and you can take that and look the other way, or else the other choice is we'll shoot you. Now, it takes an unusually strong man to be able to resist that temptation, and many of those strong men then end up dead. That's one sort of problem. We also have the problem of corrupt officials very high up in all sorts of countries. But I think that there's another way we have to look at it, that there are a lot of people that depend for their livelihood on capital that is generated by the drug trade. I mean, anyone looking at what has happened to the economy of northern Thailand in the past 10 years has seen an economic boom. Now, that capital has been generated by the smuggling trade, not all drugs, some jade and tungsten ore and all sorts of other things that are smuggled. There was an article in the Far Eastern Economic Review a couple of weeks ago in which it pointed out that the Thai textile industry, perfectly legitimate industry, could not exist in its present form if it weren't for the goods that were smuggled to Burma. All right, well, how does Burma pay for these goods? These goods are paid for effectively in opium. Similarly, on the level of a traditional economy, the entire trading network from southern China across northern Shan states in Burma, Thailand, and Laos is based upon opium not only as a generator of capital, but also as a currency, because you have a liquidity problem in these traditional economies. You can also look at places where coca serves the same function in South America. The estimate is that coca represents 50% of the total exports of Peru. Well, when we say to the Peruvians, hey, we're worried about cocaine. We don't know exactly why. It's not really a big problem, but we're worried about it. And we want you to knock out this crop. that it's producing 50% of your total export revenue. Not surprisingly, you get the response from some Peruvians who are perhaps less polite than the ones who you know, say nice things to foreigners, that, well, how do you feel about, for instance, wiping out your tobacco industry in Virginia? In other words, if you want to sort of weigh drugs, it's easier to show harm from tobacco than cocaine. That is not advocating that your listeners immediately go up and stock up on cocaine. But the point is that until we address the kinds of problems that the people in these countries are concerned about, not just the people at the top who want helicopters and want other goodies to play with, we're not going to be able to develop any sort of really effective policy. And when Peter was talking about, yes, heroin in the United States went down. It's now on the way up again. But when you look at drug abuse, it's not always clear what that means. In other words, if the price purity level of heroin, the price goes up, the purity level goes down, it means that people are also shooting something else that's mixed into it. We're not sure that that's always necessarily a good thing. It could be strychnine, could be a lot of other things that stuff is cut with.
Well, Peter Bourne, David Feingold has just made an argument that it's actually disadvantageous for a lot of countries to cut down on the growth or production of drugs. Do you agree with that? And if so, what is the way that the United States government can deal with that so that we're making it possible in order to cut down on drugs in our own country, for there to be something in it for the other countries who are making all these profits
from
the drugs?
Well, yes, I mean, it has to do with fundamentally with the fact that there is a gross inequity in the world, in the world's economic system, between the poor countries of the world and the rich countries of the world. And we have, in effect, said that the drugs that we make money out of, primarily tobacco and alcohol, will be treated completely differently from the drugs that poor countries in the world make money out of, regardless of the deleterious effect that they might have. There is absolutely no question that tobacco and alcohol causes far more health problems throughout the world than all of these other drugs put together. 50,000 Americans a year die from lung cancer. Somewhere around 2,000 to 3,000 die from heroin overdoses. So, I mean, there's no comparison at all. But it has to do with a kind of hypocrisy about our view as to our right to make money in the world. And I don't think there is any question but that in some instances it is extremely beneficial to some developing countries to have the substantial flow of foreign currency come into the country. One can make the same argument in favor of prostitution in Thailand, which probably brings in somewhere between $2 and $3 billion a year in foreign exchange, and it is mainly money that ends up in the hands of people in small villages, because the girls who work in prostitution send the money back to their families. It is probably a far better system for redistributing wealth than any of the AID aid foreign aid programs. However, all of these systems of economic benefit, those countries pay a price for. And I think that the Thais pay a price as far as heroin is concerned in recent years, particularly because a very serious heroin problem has developed among the Thais themselves. When all of the heroin was going overseas and only being consumed by Europeans, and they were making money out of it only from Europeans, one could make a stronger argument in favor of what David is saying. Now that there are somewhere, I've heard figures of 200,000 or 300,000 heroin addicts in Bangkok, the Thais themselves are paying a very high price. And I think in the long run, the short-term benefits of being involved in the heroin traffic are going to be outweighed by the negative aspects of it.
Let me just reintroduce you both. Just speaking was Peter Bourne, who formulated America's drug control policies under President Carter. With us also is David Feingold of the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, and he's the director of the Center for the Center for Opium Research at ISHE, and he's been studying the opium production and trade in Southeast Asia for about 20 years now. David, you had, or perhaps still are, in support of a very unusual kind of program called a buyback program, which is an attempt to address the problems that you've both just been addressing, the economic problems. Can you explain that program?
Well, I think, let me just give you a little brief background as to what this is addressing. One of the key problems is that within the drug trade, you have two sets of victims. You have the addicts at one end, and you have the farmers at the other. Opium is a difficult crop to grow. It takes a minimum of 387 man-hours to raise 1.5 kilos of opium. You get rain at the wrong time of year, your crop is wiped out. The average household will make anywhere, depending on the price, between $50 and $100 for a year's worth of labor. These are the growers. These are not the traffickers. Traffickers are a different situation. So the question is that the people, it seems to me, who have the greatest call on our concern are, first of all, the addicts who suffer from the direct health effects and social effects of drug abuse on the one hand, and the farmers who generally grow opium because they can't grow anything else. So obviously, in the long term, the only kind of long-term solution you can have to drug production, unless you want to institute a terror policy, there's no question if we atom-bombed the northern half of Burma, there would in fact be no poppies and we would have solved the poppy problem. Might be a few other little negative results of that, but it would certainly solve the poppy problem. But if you're not prepared to go to those sorts of lengths, the only way that you can get people to stop growing these crops is if you give them something that will give them not necessarily more income but less risk. Because the traditional farmer seeks not so much to maximize profit as to minimize risk and to make his profit predictable. Now, in order to be able to do that, as Peter pointed out before, you need to have some sort of conditions of political stability. The problem in Burma is that the Burmese government has not been able to... We can go over this very briefly. In 1948, when the Union of Burma was created, and Burma gained its independence from Britain, the minority peoples of Burma agreed to join, people like the Shans, who are not in fact Burmese, agreed to join the Union of Burma under a constitution that gave them the rights of local autonomy and the right to secede from the Union of Burma after 10 years. And when Ne Win came in and threw out the constitution in 1962, General Ne Win, and seized power, one of the problems is he abrogated the rights that the minorities had. So what's been going on since 1962, to simplify a very complicated situation, is that the minority peoples have been seeking what they call independence, but what really they're looking for is local autonomy in their own region. Now, until there is some sort of a political solution between the central government of Burma and the minority peoples, there's going to be no possibility for any sort of development program. There was a very amusing thing that happened. Somebody once said, I forget who it was that testified, but some government official testified that we were going to apply the lessons learned in the crop replacement program in Thailand, which hasn't been notoriously successful, to Burma. And over a five-year period, we tried to find out where in Burma there was a crop replacement program. As of 2 weeks ago, nobody in Washington seemed to know. We found out it was supposedly at a place called Hay Ho. Nobody's been able to locate Hay Ho. But when I was in Thailand, DEA men were rushing to the airport with queen bees, which were going to be brought to Burma in order to participate in this crop replacement program. Well, obviously, this is not going to change the net production of Burma very much. Until you get a political solution, there's no possibility for it doing so. So then you have to look at interim measures. Now, given the fact that the United States is committed to a supply control strategy, whether that's wise or not wise, all the recent governments of the United States have been committed to a supply control strategy. You can either do it efficiently or inefficiently. Right now, we're doing it extremely inefficiently. We stopped 3%. That's not very efficient. So what we suggested was that, at least for Burma, and there might be different sorts of systems one would use in different parts of the world, that as an interim measure, that since the people who controlled the trade, first-stage traffickers, were willing to sell their crop legally, because they don't care whether they sell it legally or illegally, that the ideal thing would be to buy up the crop and take it, and you could either turn it into medicinal codeine or dump it in the ocean. But it would be far more cost-effective than what we're doing now. Right now, we're spending a great deal of money and not stopping the crop. Ideally, of course, you'd like to be able to buy it from each individual farmer, but you can't do that because of logistic reasons, which is why we proposed that perhaps the best way to do it was to deal with first-stage traffickers.
This buyback proposal was made while you were working with the Carter administration, and it's a proposal that you rejected. What do you think the flaws are with the buyback system?
Well, there are a whole series of problems with it. Some of them are just mechanical problems in terms of carrying it out, and others obvious diplomatic problems. There is an insurgency movement in northeast Burma that gets money from selling opium. At the same time, the United States government has formal diplomatic relations with the government of Burma, and the U.S. government could not possibly use the taxpayers' money to subsidize an armed insurrection against a government that we have diplomatic relations with, any more than the U.S. government could subsidize the military activities of the PLO or any other insurgent group. I think on a practical level, you've got problems in terms of not knowing how elastic the supply is potentially. If the Burmese traffickers could count each year on getting the U.S. government, the U.S. taxpayers, to buy, say, 400 tons of opium, one really has no way of knowing for certain that they couldn't then grow 800 tons and continue the illicit traffic and at the same time pick up the $35 million that we were talking about having to spend on it. I think also that I think David and I disagree rather strongly on this, that the political viability of the independence movements of the minorities in Burma has been grossly overstated. My view of the traffickers is that they're interested in making money and sort of petty banditry much more than they are in any sort of political settlement with the central government in Burma. And I have seen very little evidence of any organized political group representing the minorities in Burma. And in fact, despite what the central government in Burma may have done with regard to the old constitution, the minorities are extremely well represented in the government in Rangoon. So I think also it's worth pointing out that when former Congressman Wolf held the hearings on this issue in the Congress, he was unable to get anybody to testify in favor of it. All those who testified against it, and nobody was in support of it. So I think it is sort of diplomatically unrealistic and practically unworkable, although obviously simple solutions have great appeal, and I think that this sort of falls into that category.
Do you think that the obstacles that Peter Bourne mentioned could ever be overcome, David Feingold?
Well, I think that you finally wanted to find something we disagreed about. Most of the things that you've talked about, we've agreed a lot about. Let's go through them in order. First of all, the question is, we are buying it now, except now we're buying it retail instead of buying it wholesale. So that the question is of subsidizing an insurgency. I think that one has to look at this in somewhat more complex terms, in terms of no one else supporting it. In fact, in the Thai parliament, there was a bill that was sponsored by 120 members of the Thai parliament that, in fact, favored this proposal. And then there was, in fact, a military coup which overthrew the Thai government of that particular time. But, in other words, the United States has dealt with people who are not governments before. We did it in Angola. We did it in lots of other places. It's possible to do this. It's also possible to set up a structure. We do, in fact, deal at some level, when necessary, with the PLO through intermediaries, various other ways. I think that is something, you know, we pay diplomats a great deal of money to do things. I'm sure they could figure out a vehicle for doing it. I don't see that as an insurmountable problem. It's a real problem, but not an insurmountable one. Now, I think that one of the main questions, the questions of elasticity of supply, the limiting factor on opium production is labor. Remember I told you before, it takes minimum 367 man-hours to produce 1.6 kilos of opium using traditional methods. Now, you have there people who, in fact, cannot alter their technology very much. The only thing they can manipulate is their labor. To some extent, you can manipulate water. Opium, they can't bring in chemical fertilizers. I remember I once gave a talk from NIDA, and someone showed up from DEA and asked me, well, why couldn't they bring in more labor? And I said, well, where are they going to bring this from? And he said, well, why couldn't you truck it in from Yunnan? And as I pointed out, if you could truck anything in from Yunnan in significant amounts, you wouldn't have to grow opium in the first place. In other words, there's every incentive that people need to grow opium now. You're not adding to that incentive. The other thing is that it is very clear in every single study that's been done on opium production that labor is the limiting factor. But there's a very simple solution to this. One doesn't have to take my word for it. I've studied labor inputs into opium production. One doesn't have to take Peter Bourne's word. One of the things that the minority people say is, why don't you come in and look? Now, one of the things that the Burmese have been very reluctant to do is to let anyone come in and look. They'll let you go to Rangoon or you can fly around in a helicopter. But nobody's been able to do any detailed studies on the ground there. So the answer is, if there's any question, you go in and measure, and obviously you check. In other words, supposedly right now, we have all these sophisticated monitoring devices. When I was last in Bangkok, the American government told me how our intelligence had improved. Matter of fact, I was told, we know where every caravan is. So I said, well, why don't you stop them? And they said, well, we don't know until after they come down. So I said, so did everyone else, so does everyone else in northern Thailand. In other words, the point is, if this is a question, which in my mind it isn't a question, but if it is, let's send someone in and look. Third point is the question of the government of Burma. Now, right now I think it's very difficult for Peter to enter, working for the United Nations, to enter into a debate on the relative merits of the government of the Union of Burma. But I would say that the question of minority representation in the government is virtually ludicrous. In other words, the Burmese army is thoroughly detested. It goes in, it burns down villages, rapes women, and as a matter of fact, in their recent Mohain, which means Thunderbolt, 6 operation, which was supposedly directed against opium traffickers, the main result was that they stole 400 head of Lahu cattle, which they took back to Mong Sot. In other words, none of these insurgencies could maintain themselves for 20 years if it wasn't for the fact that they had the support. Obviously, no insurgency has the support of all the people. Obviously, you have a lot of different groups there. You have groups that range from what Americans might see as, quote, revolutionaries to others who they might see as traditional bandits. But the one thing that everyone is unified about is that they don't want the Burmese in there. They don't want the Burmese army in there attacking their villages. They don't want them stealing their cattle, and they don't want them raping their women, which seems to me something that's basically easy for people to understand. Now, the fact is that rather than being part of the solution, we've been part of the problem. We have never turned to the Burmese and said, look, we will give our good offices towards bringing about a solution. In fact, this is not a particularly difficult problem to solve. It's a lot less difficult than, for instance, the Arab-Israeli conflict to solve. This seems to me to be something that we ought to start doing. If we're really concerned about drugs, we ought to be concerned about getting them off the market in the most efficient means possible.
Peter Bourne, does that sound convincing to you?
Well, I think it's probably not worth getting too sidetracked on this rather esoteric issue. I do think there is a real problem in the idea that the United States can go in and tell any other sovereign government how to handle its internal affairs. And I think we get into real difficulties, particularly with a country like Burma, which most Americans know so little about, if we figure in this country that we know how to sort out their domestic problems. I mean, we would not be wild about the Burmese coming here and telling us how to handle racial problems in this country. So that I think to a certain extent we have to give the Burmese the freedom to sort out their own internal domestic problems.
I think that would be fine, except there's one problem. In other words, we're not leaving the Burmese free to sort out their domestic problems. We're giving them helicopters and aircraft. And this year in the State Department request to Congress, they've asked to be able to provide the Burmese with an aircraft maintenance capability.
This is aircraft to help for drug policing?
It is for whatever that is the theory.
That's the theory. With the intention.
It is with the intention of doing that.
These aircraft and helicopters are completely unarmed and are purely for transportation, mainly because the areas where the opium is grown are very inaccessible by road for the most part. And without using helicopters, it's almost impossible to get there in any reasonable period of time. And they are purely for transportation.
Have you found that they were getting used for other reasons beyond drug control?
No. We disagree on this.
I see that. Okay, I'm going to change the subject. And first I'll reintroduce you. I have two guests with me. David Feingold, who's based in Philadelphia, where he's the director of the Center for Opium Research, which is part of ISHI, the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, based at the Science Center in West Philadelphia. Also with me is Peter Bourne, who formulated the drug control policy under President Carter when he served in the administration. He's currently the Assistant Secretary General of the UN's International Drinking Water Supply and Sanitation Decade. What about decriminalization? What that would do would not help necessarily the health problems of people who are addicted to drugs, but it seems like it might clear up a lot of the economic problems and the crime problems that result out of drugs being sold and transported through a black market and being operated by crime figures of great power and great influence. Would decriminalization be a notion that could ever be entertained, do you think, by this country? And what effects do you think that it would have, Peter Bourne?
It's a notion that has extraordinary appeal, and I think that although I have taken a lot of grief for saying this in the past, that no thinking person who is considering this issue cannot have looked at this option, because I think, as I said before, the economic damage and having this vast economy outside our legitimate economy is causing far more damage than the pharmacological effects of the drugs themselves. The biggest problem is a political one. It is virtually unsaleable to the American people. I tried for years to get people to understand that there was a difference, for instance, between decriminalization and legalization, and I think completely failed. The American people want to know when it comes to drugs, are you for it or against it? And there's no in-between. So that decriminalization is a shade of difference that is too subtle for people to understand. And I think on that basis, particularly given the trend in the country in the last year towards a much more conservative bent, that people want tougher law enforcement. They want more people put away for trafficking in drugs. We've just had the President's Crime Commission talking about spending $2 billion on building new prisons in the country. $2 billion when they're talking about cutting out social research, cutting back on social service programs. The climate in the country, and certainly the climate in this administration, is not one that is going to look favorably on that kind of option as a solution to the drug problem. But it's something that any thinking person has to think about.
Well, were it not for the negative reaction that you think the American public would have to a decriminalization proposal, is this something that you, as an informed individual who's created drug policies, would seriously entertain?
Well, in formulating any sort of policy, whether it's drugs or anything else, you trade off, you balance off what the pros and cons are. You have some terrible potential liabilities if you decriminalize or even legalize drugs. What we really don't know if heroin was really made available, what percentage of the population would opt to use it in large quantities, and what kind of devastating effect we might be buying into in society. We've got enough problems with alcohol already, with 10% of the country alcoholics. If we made heroin available, we might just face disastrous situations. So to some extent, whatever the failings may be of our present policies, if it's exerting some constraint in reducing the total number of addicts, it may be good what we're doing now, may be adequate. I think what worries a lot of people about the idea of decriminalizing particularly heroin is that we just don't know what the potential effect would be. In China, prior to 1948, when opium was readily available, and particularly during the 19th century when the British were forcing the Chinese to make opium essentially available to everybody, the percentage of people who were addicted to opium in cities like Shanghai was astronomically high, and it was obviously terribly destructive to Chinese society. And a lot of people, myself included, have great trepidation about the risks that we would potentially run if we made heroin more available than it is.
What do you think of decriminalization?
Again, I think we're back to points that we agree on. Actually, we agree more than we disagree. Where we disagree violently. I think that there's a couple of very, very important points. I think that when you look at decriminalization, I agree with Peter that political environment is such that it becomes suspect for people, and many researchers have been attacked for merely not even advocating, but merely saying, okay, what sorts of problems would we have? What are the potential methods for decriminalization? And looking at the implications. This, I think, is a very, very dangerous situation, because the fact is that by any measure, our policies, and you can go back 50 years, our policies have failed. We still have a lot of people abusing drugs, and it doesn't look like in the near future we're going to have less people abusing drugs. So that it's very important to look at decriminalization. Secondly, I would say you have to look at decriminalization as a possibility and look at it, make it drug-specific. In other words, for example, I think I would feel far more sanguine about the decriminalization of certainly marijuana or cocaine even than I would about heroin. The question of exactly how many people would take heroin if it were freely available is unclear. On the one hand, there is the example of opium in China. On the other hand, there are the examples of the fact that opium was readily available and easily available in Turkey for a very long time, and you had practically no heroin use. The other point about China is that opium was known in China for a very, very long time. As a matter of fact, the ban on tobacco smoking in China, the imperial ban on tobacco smoking, preceded the first imperial ban on opium smoking by nearly 100 years. In fact, it wasn't until tobacco came, and along with it, smoking came to China, that there developed an opium problem. So the whole Chinese question is terribly complex. The other point that I would make, though, is that not considering decriminalization and not looking at it in a very careful and scientific way pushes us back to the idea that we can lock people up in jail who do things that we don't like. And that, I think, is a very, very dangerous thing. There's another point that I think that it's very important to emphasize. I think all of us who are in the field of looking at drugs tend to emphasize, you know, heroin or PCP or the if you'd like, more bizarre forms of drug use. But in fact, these don't represent the major problems. I mean, the much more major problems are things like tobacco and alcohol and tranquilizers. And as Peter and I were talking before we came in here, the whole problem of solvent and glue sniffing, which is now spreading around the world and becoming an incredibly serious problem, cannot be controlled by controlling the supply. There are kids in Thailand who are sniffing gasoline and putting plastic bags over the exhaust pipes of motorcycles and then sniffing the contents. There's no way that you can either lock those people up in jail or lock motorcycle manufacturers up in jail. And we really don't have a very good idea of how to deal with these sorts of problems. One of the problems also is that prevention, which is very important, involves in evaluation the measurement of non-events. And you can't measure events that don't happen, which means that in the kind of political and economic climate that you have in the United States today, it's very difficult to justify prevention programs, even though really they're much more important than either treatment programs or buyback programs or enforcement programs. Every kid that you can keep off bad drugs is much more important than any of these other things that we're talking about.
If drugs were decriminalized, what effects do you think it would have on crime rings in America and all the people who are collectively making more money than the oil companies, as you both pointed out a little earlier in the show? Do you think it would break up those crime rings?
It would be a great bar to upward mobility.
What do you think, Peter Bourne?
Well, that's right. I think you've got two kinds of people. You've got the people who already were on the fringe of lawlessness, who would just look for some other commodity to get into. One of the things that is already taking over in some parts of Latin America is forging U.S. currency, and people are getting out of the drug business and forging U.S. currency as a way of making more money. And then you've got the people who are in it because they, who are basically people who are inside the law normally, who just see a way of making a quick buck. And I think if it was legalized, they would just be out of it and probably would not get into something else illegal.
It's very profitable now, isn't it, for people who are in drug crime rings to, particularly when dealing with addictive drugs, get as many people hooked as possible. So is that something that needs to be measurably?
That's a little bit of a myth, though.
Is it?
Yes. In other words, drug dealers do not, I mean, the image that I think you and I were in school at the same time when we were little kids, and the image of the chap standing outside of the schoolyard saying, "Psst, you want to have some heroin," is not, in fact, really very accurate. Drug dealers, for reasons of safety, prefer to deal with customers that they know. There's enough spread by people learning how to use it from their friends and everything else. But I think that there's no question that if you had some sort of a decriminalization program, and you could have lots of different types, and that would be very complex to design them, but if you did, it would take out the majority of the profits. It would get that amount of money out of organized crime. Organized crime is one of the most successful transnational corporations in the world. They'd find other things to do. As Peter pointed out, that these people in Latin America went from making money to making money. So instead of making money with drugs, they made it with a printing press. But you would get the worst aspects of the criminal parts of drug abuse out of the public sector.
You know what I've always wondered? For the person who's a junkie, they not only deal with the addictive drug, but then they've got organized crime on their backs also, and then they get sent to jail after that. So it seems to me we're certainly making it really hard on people who have health problems related to illegal drugs.
Yes. Well, one of the points that David made I think is very important, and that is that we sort of talk about drug abuse and addiction as though it's one entity. But making our addressing of the problem drug-specific, I think, is extremely important, because the real money being made in this country at the moment is not being made from heroin, it's being made from marijuana. And you can deal with that problem without getting into many of the difficulties that we've talked about with regard to decriminalizing heroin. And to some extent, apart from the political problems, the arguments for decriminalizing marijuana are overwhelming, I think, in many respects, and you could overnight eliminate a lot of this economic problems that you have as a result of marijuana trafficking.
So if it wasn't for public opinion, which is not in favor of or fully comprehensive of...
Yes. I mean, there's very little constituency that's organized effectively politically to support a politician who will take the risk of saying, "I favor decriminalization." But there are overwhelmingly organized political groups, not the least of which is the Moral Majority, that will go after in the most vicious way anybody who stands up and says that. So the opposition to it is very strong, very well organized. And I would not advise a politician today to favor decriminalization unless he just wants to get knifed by very organized conservative groups.
Well, it's interesting. There's been so much money spent on anti-drug abuse films that I think a lot of young people gather together and laugh at. And very little money, to my knowledge, spent on education about decriminalization and the difference between decriminalization and legalization and what it would mean. And when you're thinking about are you for it or are you against it, what are some of the things that you should know? Do you think it would be possible for a government to embark just on an education program, not even pro or con, but just explaining what it is?
Yes, today it wouldn't get beyond first base in the Congress. There have been groups in the Drug Abuse Council that was supported by a number of foundations, I thought, did a superb job in trying to do that, to raise the issues as objectively as they could. But it was a small-scale operation.
Terry, excuse me. I think that there's one other very important point about this, that the work of institutions like the Drug Abuse Council and a number of other places that attempted to present a variety of different views. They did not have a unified view, are now very often portrayed as being essentially in favor of pushing drugs. And I think that this has created a very, very dangerous environment. I was at a hearing a few weeks ago in which the director of NIDA was specifically asked by a congressman as to why it was that, in fact, a NIDA bibliography, that's National Institute on Drug Abuse bibliography, contained references to some publications by NORML, which is the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Now, NIDA was not advocating NORML's position, nor was it criticizing. It was producing a bibliography of things published in the area. And they had to then defend this position. Now, in that sort of environment, you don't get very informed policy.
Peter Bourne, what do you think we can expect from the Reagan administration's policies on drug control and drug abuse?
It's too hard to tell at the moment.
And I should tell you, you've only got about a minute to tell me.
Well, there's very little to say, and that the nobody really has made any public statements at all. If I say anything, to a certain extent, it'd be reflecting my own bias. But given their attitude towards other issues, I think that we can expect a heavy emphasis on law enforcement activities, a very little concern for treatment of addicts, and a reduction in the research money that goes into dealing with some of these fundamental issues.
Anything you'd add, David?
Yes. I'd agree with that. And the other thing I'd say is that they are going to, in effect, cripple effective research for the period of time that they're in office. And secondly, I think that in terms of overseas, considering that they're considering in Colombia and a number of other places, I think that there's going to be more of the same, only it's going to be less effective and worse.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much. It's been extremely interesting, and I thank you very much for participating. I've had two guests with me. With me has been Peter Bourne, who formulated America's drug control policy under President Carter when he served as special assistant for health issues, which included responsibilities for drug abuse policy. Currently, he's the Assistant Secretary General of the UN's International Drinking Water Supply and Sanitation Decade. Also with me for a return visit to Fresh Air has been David Feingold, who's been studying the opium trade in Southeast Asia, the area known as the Golden Triangle, for 20 years. His work started when he was an anthropologist, and through studying the economic and social structures of the people there, he became very interested in poppy growth and trade.